I've got a really nice A5 black folder that I put all my sermons in. I cut them up with a guillotine from... not before I've done it. I print them off like this on A4, which is two sheets of A5, and then I cut them down the middle nice and neatly with a guillotine. I put them nicely in this thing, and then I bring it with me, and I open it up, and I know exactly where I am. But of course, we're moving the house yesterday. I've got no idea where it is. So, thankfully, I did find my sermon, so we're all right as far as that goes. So I've got something to be able to share with you this morning. So here we are. We've arrived at this part in Mark's Gospel. It's sort of part two, if you like. Any of you that were here last time when we looked at the end of chapter 4 and beginning of chapter 5, we saw those two great miracles of Jesus. The first one where he stands and he calms the storm on the lake. And it's incredible, isn't it? Because you know, the disciples just suddenly get this sense that they're in the presence of someone far different to who they thought he was. You know, it's not just a teacher that needs to be followed. There's something far more amazing about this guy. And then he goes over to the side of the lake and he heals the man that's been possessed by the demons. And that guy wants to come and he wants to go back with Jesus. He says, "I want to follow you." And Jesus says, "Well, no, I want you to go and tell the people what's happened to you." And he's sent out from there. So the first two things, we saw that Jesus had power over nature and then he had power over evil. And this is part two, in a sense, because we continue to build on that. You know, that's not the end of it. He hasn't just got power over nature and power over evil, and that's it, and everything else is sort of out of his control. Mark is continuing to build the picture for us, to show us more and more of who this Jesus is, more and more of this power that he has. He shows his authority in ways which are beyond our control. The power over nature, the power over sickness, and we now move on to two more remarkable episodes. Jesus' power or authority over death itself, and his authority over sickness. Now he's put all of these four together to reveal to us a little bit more about who Jesus is. I don't know if you remember, if you were here when we first started looking at the gospel, but we said that the first half is Mark trying to explain to us who Jesus is, up to the sort of halfway through chapter 8, that confession of Peter's, that he's the Christ, we get there. And then from then on, he changes tack. He's no longer trying to reveal who he is, he's showing us what he came to do. So the gospel can quite easily be split into two halves. And we're still in that first half. We should still be asking this question, who is Jesus? And that's, I think, no matter how long we've been Christians, we should still be asking this question. And of course, if you aren't a Christian, the whole point is that you should be asking this question. Who is he? Who is he? And Mark has even put it plainly for us in what we should be asking in chapter 4 and verse 41. That's the question that should be on our lips. Those closest to him, his disciples, ask it when he's just calmed the storm. Who is this? Who is this? They've got their preconceived ideas, and we've got ours. But what we saw in that episode was that they were shaken out of them, because after fearing for their lives, you know, it struck me as I was preparing it, after fearing for their very lives, you know, the just sheer panic and fear, they thought they were going to die. And then Jesus stands up, he calms the storm, and a whole different fear comes upon them. Because they're in the presence of someone that was even more powerful than that. And that's the same in the second story as well, when we get the demon-possessed man. You know, the people have got used to living with him. You know, they keep him in the tombs area. They don't like it, and it'd be better if he wasn't there. But there's something familiar about it. There's a little bit of fear there. But then when Jesus comes, and Jesus delivers him, you know, there's a whole different sort of fear. And they're like, "You've just got to leave this place. Get out, go. You know, we don't want to deal with this." That fear comes upon them. They're in the presence of someone even greater. Those two episodes were on the other side, well, either on the lake or on the other side of the lake. But now we see Jesus is back. 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake. Jesus is back and the crowds are back. And if we sit back long enough, we're expecting, in a sense, normality to return. Jesus' kind of normality, not our kind of normality. We're expecting the crowds there. It must be time for more teaching or some more parables. But something else happens, doesn't it? It takes our attention straight away. And it's just an aside, but isn't Mark a great storyteller? As you look through it and as you read it, he wrote his gospel in the first place to be read to others, to be listened to, really, rather than read. So someone would grab it and they would read it, and lots of people would be listening to it. And he was aware of that. He wanted to keep their attention, and there's fast-moving things. Now, I don't know, as millions and millions queued up for it and at 12 o'clock on a Saturday night before it was just about to be released. I don't know as they did. But it was that sort of nail-biting thing, wasn't it, when they would have first got it. So much better than a Harry Potter book, because it deals with truth. So this thing that happens, it takes our attention away. We're expecting, in a sense, to go back to, say, Jesus' normality, which would be teaching and parables and things like that. But this crisis situation arrives. And it's another building block that we're supposed to add to our thinking about who is this. Verses 21 to 24, a girl dying. The desperate situation of a parent in a horrible place just falls at Jesus' feet and pleads with him. So what he does, he's got nowhere else to go, he's got nothing else to do, he just comes before Jesus and he pleads with him. And Jesus follows, as we see. And what happens next? I mean, if you could write, I don't know if you're a fan of Question of Sport, but they like to do that sort of section, don't they, where they show you a normal match happening, football match or golf or tennis or something, and then they just cut it off right then and say, what happened next? And it's obviously not the normal thing, like, well, he just carried on running down the field, because that would just be a little bit daft and boring, wouldn't it? It's something out of the ordinary. And it's quite funny trying to get these people to guess it, because they know it's out of the ordinary, so they try and bring things, different things up. So, well, he must have, you know, run into the goalpost and it fell down and the crossbar fell on his head and knocked him out, and then an ambulance drove onto the pitch and they're like, no, that's not what happened. But you're naturally expecting something, aren't you? And that's what's happening here. You're naturally expecting something to happen. You know, okay, we've got another healing coming up. That's what's going to happen. That's not what's going to happen at all. What happens next? Someone else also needs help. But she doesn't want to make a scene. We have the contrast, don't we, between the named synagogue ruler, Jairus, the important person, comes and bows himself before Jesus, the important official. And then we have this sort of unclean woman who has been bleeding for 12 years, who's in such a desperate situation. All she wants to do is touch him. She doesn't want to bring any attention to herself. You know, maybe she's heard the story of the leper in chapter 1. He was unclean. And yet when he came to Jesus and touched Jesus, Jesus wasn't made unclean, which is the way that it should have happened. He was made clean. Or maybe she's heard this story and she's thinking, well, all I need to do is touch him. Maybe that's given her hope. So in verse 28 we see, if I just touch his cloak, I will be healed. You see the faith, in a sense, the hope that's there. All I need to do is get somewhere near him. I don't need to make a scene. I don't need to call out from the side of the road. I just need to, as he's walking by, just grab his cloak. Who is this? That's all you have to do. Verse 29, immediately her bleeding stopped. And she must have been amazed. How long has she been planning it? Was it a spur of the moment thing? She just saw him walking by and thought, I'm just going to touch him. Was it something that she thought about for weeks and weeks and weeks? We don't know. But we do know that for 12 years she's suffered the emotional, physical, social pain of the disease that has cost her everything she has. And she's in a desperate situation. But now, it's gone. Now, she's free from her sufferings, we see in verse 29. She's healed after a secret encounter with Jesus. Even in the midst of a busy crowd, it's a secret encounter. Because only she knows what has happened. As far as everyone else is concerned, she's just doing what they were doing. She's just crowding around Jesus, probably trying to get a little bit nearer. The relief I've done it. I've touched him. I'm better. Only it isn't as simple as that, is it? Because there is someone else who knows what's happened. In effect, she's been found out. And she hears the words, "Who touched me?" And she stops. And she's like, "No." And immediately her heart sinks and it's like, it was supposed to be a secret. People don't like me. I'm not the sort of person that's in the middle of attention all the time. I just wanted to touch Jesus. I just wanted to take something from you. Don't draw attention to me. Please don't draw attention to me. The disciples come to her defense. "What are you talking about, Jesus? What do you mean? Who touched you? Look around you. I mean, he did, she did, he did, she..." You know? And she's like, "Yeah, that's right. You know, Jesus, you've got to go and heal a girl. You know, that's your priority at this moment in time. You go, I'm just going to carry on going over here. I'm going to try and put my life back together. Leave it, Jesus. Please, leave it." She walks away. But then she turns, maybe, and she sees his eyes. And he isn't going anywhere. They're searching for her. And she sees him, her Saviour, and she falls at his feet, trembling with fear, because, once again, one more powerful than her disease is there, and she just simply tells him the whole truth. And this is incredible, isn't it? He isn't angry, he isn't frustrated, he doesn't blame her, he doesn't accuse her, he doesn't touch her and give her back what she had, or tell her to get in line. He doesn't blame her for holding him up when he's got to go and heal somebody else. He doesn't rebuke her for coming in secret. What does he do? What does Jesus do? He adds to her blessing. That's why he's looking for her. He's not looking for her so she can hold an account of herself. She hasn't got to explain her actions. He wants to add to her blessings. He wants her to realize that it wasn't his clothing that made her well. It wasn't superstition. It was him. It was Jesus. She has trusted in him and she has not been disappointed. And then I think we have one of the best titles in the whole Bible. This woman who has been excluded from society because of her uncleanness, Jesus says, "Daughter, daughter, your faith has healed you." She trusted in him. And that was what he was looking for. That's what Jesus was looking for. You see, we can't come to Jesus in secret, can we? Our faith has to be an open faith. As we see here confessing it publicly, here, it leads to even more blessings. Who is this? Who is this? Is it the man who gets his priorities wrong? Is it the man who is so bothered about bringing other people's faith out into the open that it's going to be at the expense of a young girl's life? Is that the result of saving one person that there just isn't enough time to do it all? You know, you've got to pick and choose, surely. I mean, after all, he is a man, isn't he? Well, he is, isn't he? But he's not only a man. He's not just a man. Do you see the concern of Jairus and his servants? You can see the scene unfolding, can't you? We must go and get the teacher before she dies. There is a cut-off point here. We're up against it. There is a time limit. Once she dies, that's too late. That's in their thinking, isn't it? It's right there. We must go and get the teacher before she dies. Of course that's the course of action. He can do it. He will make her well. So Jairus goes to where he thinks Jesus might be, but he's not there. "Well, where is he?" he asks around the crowd. Where's Jesus? "So, well, he's been over the other side of the lake. He's been gone for a while. We don't know when he's coming. There's a rumour that he may be back today." And so he's hanging around. Maybe. He waits as the clock ticks. And then he sees him in the crowd and he gets to him and he falls at his feet again in that desperate situation because she is going to die. And then, as we've seen, he is distracted and she does die. That's it. That's the end. Nothing can be done now. His servants come and they say, there's no point in bothering him now. Verse 35. Jesus. He doesn't ignore them, does he? He just turns to the synagogue ruler. And notice that we're reminded of his position here, not his name. He turns to the synagogue ruler, reminds him of his position and his responsibility. He says, don't be afraid, just believe. How would that have sounded to the guy at the time? I don't know. Try and put yourself in Jairus' position. What do you mean? She's dead. What do you mean? Don't be afraid, just believe. Did suddenly a spark of hope come back into his heart, into his mind? Did he think, is she not dead? Do you know something I don't know? Jesus is looking for that sort of trust. He commended the woman who had been bleeding for having it, and now he tells the synagogue ruler to have it. Just believe. Something incredible happens, doesn't it? And we have something else to throw into the mix when considering this question, who is this? He has authority over death. He isn't caught out by circumstances. He can only do so much. He is over every situation. He takes his inner group of Peter and James and John and the girl's parents. He goes into the room and he raises her up. And he tells those there, she's not dead. Well, I think he means she's not dead in the way we understand death. They see it as final. There's no point in bothering the teacher anymore. She's dead. That's it. We see them wailing and crying loudly in verse 38, the natural response of knowing that someone has died. There's something final about it. And we know exactly what they mean, don't we? We know exactly what they mean. That's how we view it. If someone dies, we know that we're not going to see them physically anymore. But Jesus says this death is more like sleep because he has authority even over death. Death no longer has to be the end. Praise God. That's why we meet here this morning, isn't it? We've got that hope, haven't we, within our hearts, that for us who are trusting in the Lord Jesus Christ, death isn't the end. He raises her up because he has authority even over death itself. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? We no longer have to fear it, do we? Because we know that something even better is waiting for us the other side. So, Mark sets up for us, has shown us the power of Jesus in these four accounts. And we see something unparalleled in history. It can't be compared to anything else. It's not normal everyday stuff, is it? Jesus is unique. He is awesome. And what is great about these events is that the power isn't just being used for the sake of it. It's not a display, is it? Real situations are happening. Life is going on. And there is Jesus in the midst of it. It isn't as though everything stopped so that he can display his power and everything marveled at it for a while and then got back to normal. It isn't a show. It's not like, you know, roll up, it's the greatest show on earth. I'm going to show you some things today that you wouldn't believe. It's not magic, is it? People are involved. Proper situations, difficult situations, as we've seen. The disciples in the boat, those who are closest to Jesus, are the ones that get the harshest rebuke. The two people who have had their lives wrecked by evil and sickness. The young girl losing her life at such a young age. All adds up to the effects of sin. And we see it around us every day, don't we? That sin is still around. You only have to pick up a newspaper or watch the news. I wanted to illustrate this point last Saturday. I was away on a youth weekend. And I knew that I was illustrating a point that Saturday morning. So I just picked up the first newspaper I saw. I didn't bother reading it. I knew what it'd be full of. Didn't have to check it out and think, make sure there's some bad news in here today. It's always there, isn't it? Didn't have to pick up a particular paper. It's in all of them. I made sure there was some I didn't pick up, obviously. And we can get lost in the detail if we aren't careful. But when we step back, we see Jesus has power over sin and over the effects of sin. And we can do one of two things when we're confronted with that. And they're both here. We can believe and trust and have faith in him. Or we can say, who does he think he is? Who does he think he is? That's the reality of both the situations. The second one comes at the beginning of chapter 6, verses 1 to 6. And it's no accident that it's here, is it? There's supposed to be a contrast between faith and no faith. There's supposed to be that contrast. We see the initial enthusiasm of Jesus' homecoming. He goes back to Nazareth, preaches in the synagogue. You know, Jesus is back. You know, we've had some great things. You come and speak for us on the Sabbath. So he goes. And we don't know what he says. It's not recorded for us. But they don't like it. They don't like it at all. Who does he think he is? They say, isn't this the carpenter? Mary's son, the brother of James, Joseph, Judas and Simon. What does it tell us? They took offence at him. You see, I think we're brought up by Mark in a sense. He builds this picture of the power of Jesus. And it gets better and better. But again, we see the reality of people. There are those who won't believe in him, who won't trust in him, who won't have faith in him. He can record his stories, but the reality is there will be those who won't believe in him. And that faith is vital. That trust in him is absolutely vital, as we see in verse 5. It says he couldn't do any miracles there. Now, we don't like that, do we? You know, we want to get around that, don't we? When I'm sat there at my computer, I'm thinking, you know, if that C was a W, I mean, that would be a lot easier. You know, it would be a lot smoother Sunday morning. I can say he wouldn't do any miracles there and everyone would be fine. You know. But you've got this word, couldn't, and you think, but he's God, you know, and you think, you know, God can do anything. And, oh no, what am I going to do? You know, well, let's just skip over it and go on to the next verse. Can't do that, can we? I don't know if this is a helpful analogy or not, but you know, I don't think that God can do anything. This was quite liberating for me when I was at college. God can't be unfaithful to his own promises. If God promises to do something, he will do it. He can't not do it. He can't contradict his own character. He is completely consistent with who he is. That's the confidence that we have in him, isn't it? That as he's revealed himself, that's what he's like. When we understand a part of who God is, it's not that we worry, have to worry that tomorrow it might be different. That's why we can trust him in any and every situation, because he's completely and utterly dependable. That's why we've come before him in prayer for Tom, isn't it? You know, I would imagine that none of you have started your prayers when you're praying for Tom by saying, "Dear God, I hope you're in a good mood today, because I want to pray for this." Do you do that? It'd be a bit silly, wouldn't it? We know who it is that we come before. Someone who's completely dependable. We can trust him because he is consistent and completely trustworthy. This tells us Jesus couldn't do any miracles in that place because of their lack of faith. Now, it could be this. Because they took offense at him, they just wouldn't come to him. They wouldn't come to him for healing. And we are shown, aren't we, that Jesus won't force himself upon a situation. He won't force himself upon people and make them come in, make himself come in. There are situations where he takes the initiative. In John 5, for example, we may remember the guy next to the pool. And Jesus goes up to him and asks him if he wants to be well. But he doesn't just go and heal him and make him well. So there could be an element of that. He couldn't do any miracles there because people just weren't coming to him. Those that did, he healed. But the reality of the situation is this. If we focus on that word couldn't, we're totally missing the whole point that Mark wants us to get into our heads. So let's not let it be too much of a hang-up for us. Because if we do that, we miss the point of the passage. These passages are about faith. They're about trust. They're about belief in who Jesus is. That's where Mark's focus is. Faith in the one who can deliver us from death, ultimately. We can look forward to an eternity with him. When we are in his presence fully, and there is no more sin. That's the promise of Revelation 21, isn't it? That's what we looked at when we did that World We All Want course last year. We were saying, well, why is heaven going to be so different? Why is his being with God going to be so different to here? Why is sin going to be done away with? It's because God is the focus of everything. We'll be completely absorbed by him, looking at him all the time. There will be no more sin. And in the light of that, we can trust him now. And that may mean difficult situations. We know that all too well, don't we, at the present. But no matter what happens, we can still trust in him because we have that promise that's waiting for us. See, we live in that in-between time, don't we, where Jesus has been once, but we know that he's coming again. And the reality of the future world is breaking into this world, and we see it right here in these stories. That's exactly what's happening. A bit of heaven is breaking into earth. But then we live in that time where it's not completely here. We can see the effects of it, and we know that something's coming, but we still see the sin and the difficulties and the struggles that we have, and we've got to try and make sense of those things. But what Jesus promises is to be with us in those situations. And what we're supposed to do is to trust him. That's the reality. Do we believe and trust this Jesus? Because as I said at the beginning, God is bigger than any and every situation. God is bigger than any and every situation. In every area of our lives, is he allowed in? Are you living and trusting in him no matter what the situation? I think we can safely say that Tom is. When we get that email from him on Friday, you know, he hasn't just run away, has he? It's not that it's too much to cope with and he's just gone. He's coming before him in prayer. I mean, to know that Katrina was saying, I think she spoke to Suzanne on the Thursday before they were going through the operation, they said, well, we just feel a complete peace about the situation. Where can you get that anywhere else? Where can you get that anywhere else apart from Jesus? When we look at this passage, we can see why the writer of the letter to the Hebrews tells us to fix our eyes on Jesus, can't we? The author and perfecter of our faith. Because he knew him and trusted in him, and he wants us to do the same. So let's take encouragement at the minute that God is bigger than any and every situation. We can come before him in prayer. We ask him for healing for Tom, and that's a good thing to do. There's another prayer meeting tonight. Let's take encouragement from the fact of the one it is that we're supposed to be focusing on. Jesus has shown us that he has this power and he has this authority.